From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we meet the man who tells Johnny Carson when to break for a commercial to get rid of a boring guest. Fred DeCordova has been the executive producer of The Tonight Show since 1970. Also today, I talk with dancer and choreographer Bebe Miller. She's putting narrative energy into postmodern dance. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews composer John Zorn's homage to the world of detective writer Mickey Spillane. And television critic David Bianculli hails the return of the days and nights of Molly Dodd, the series about a New York woman alternately coping with work and unemployment, an overly attentive mother, and an ex-husband she maybe still loves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Johnny Carson needs no introduction, but my guest Fred DeCordova probably does. Since 1970, Fred DeCordova has been the executive producer of The Tonight Show. He once described his role as chief traffic cop, talent scout, number one fan, and critic all rolled into one. DeCordova was 60 by the time he joined The Tonight Show, and he was already a seasoned movie and television veteran. He directed many films, probably the best known of which is Bedtime for Bonzo, starring Ronald Reagan. On television, his credits as producer or director include The Burns and Allen Show, The Jack Benny Program, and The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. DeCordova has written an autobiography titled Johnny Came Lately. Its publication is putting the variety show producer into the guest seat for a change. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him where he sits during the taping of The Tonight Show.
Well, Johnny sits behind the desk that you've all seen often. And then there's the couch. And at the end of the couch, in a chair, an uncomfortable chair, which gives me a perfect view of Johnny's eyes and vice versa, I am there about 12 feet away from his nibs.
So you're really sitting very close. Now, you
right.
say in your book that you function as a sounding board when the going gets rough. Would you explain?
Well, I think after all the years that Johnny and I have worked together, I have a pretty good read on his reactions to what's going on. And he sometimes looks at me for verification, like it's going well or not. And those are just little minor eye moues. And I also have on my left, which is one of the most vital and compelling parts of television, a button, which means it's time to go to commercial. And although most of the world loves to get up and go to the bathroom, it's my ability to get up and go over to Johnny and say, this is going great, or why don't we go to the next guest?
So when you press that button to go to a commercial, are you sometimes doing that to bail out of a tough spot?
Yes, I think that's... let's not say a tough spot, but one that isn't going quite as well as we hoped it would.
Now, you're making this all sound very calm and organized. I want to read a quote from what Robert Blake said to Kenneth Tynan for the Kenneth Tynan Profile of Johnny Carson in The New Yorker some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Blake talking about what it's like to be a guest on The Tonight Show. He says, you better be good, or they'll go to the commercial after 2 minutes. The producer, all the federales are sitting like 6 feet away from that couch, and they're right on top of you, man, just watching you. And when they go to a break, they get on the phone, they talk upstairs, they talk to Christ, who knows? They talk all over the place about how this person's going over, how that person's going over. They whisper in John's ear. John gets on the phone and he talks. And you're sitting there watching, thinking, what are they going to hang somebody? Then when the camera comes back again, John will either ask you something else or he'll say, our next guest is. It sounds crazy.
Well, it's a little more controlled than that. There is a phone, me to the booth. There is no phone next to Johnny. We have to do evaluating, and as you do in your business or anybody else, whether something is good enough or exciting, amuses Johnny and amuses the audience. Those are our two goals. Whether it's going well enough to go to the next guest or to say, let's go a little longer with this man or woman. And then there is also the terrible problem that if you go too long with a couple of your guests, you have to say that, we're terribly sorry that so-and-so isn't with the show tonight, but we hope we'll have time the next time. So you don't like to bump people. But that, again, is dependent on how much the audience and how much Johnny are being amused.
So you're not worrying about hurting a guest's feelings while you're making these decisions?
Yes, I am. But we do start out with the fact that everybody gets paid whether they go on or not, and not that it's a munificent sum. But it is almost a guarantee that if that person is available in the immediate future, that person will be on and not be the last guest.
I'm speaking with Fred DeCordova, who has been, since 1970, the executive producer of The Tonight Show, and has written an autobiography titled Johnny Come Lately.
No, Johnny Came Lately.
Johnny Came Lately. Gosh, you know, I've been reading a Johnny Come Lately to myself all this time.
Well, you should be ashamed.
Now, you're watching the show as it happens. I always imagined you being in your office watching it on TV so that you could see what it's actually like as a program, where it would look really different than it would in real life.
Is that a question?
Well, I guess, do you run back afterwards and actually watch the broadcast to see how it looked on TV?
No, but all our shows are on tape, and if there's anything that strikes me in the actual course of the show that could have been improved or could have been handled differently, I certainly run that tape the next morning. Since we do a show, we tape it at 5:30 in the evening for airing that night, there isn't much time to do any fixing, since obviously the 5:30 show ends at 6:30, which is 9:30 in New York. And so our errors, if they exist, and of course they do from time to time, are there for the world to see. But we try not to make them twice in a row.
Well, no guest gets on the show without your approval. What's the pecking order in terms of the lineup for the evening? How do you schedule what the lineup is?
I think you try to, if you go way back to vaudeville or even in a book, you try to mix your show so that there aren't all musicians, all authors, all camera freaks, or all civilians. You try to mix it so that the audience, and we know it's a vast one, gets a little bit of each possible area of entertainment. The normal running order would be the star, the comedian, the musician, and that goes sometimes in another area. We have...
And then the book author, right?
The book author is the bumpy, ordinarily, yes. I've bumped myself twice in the last 2 weeks.
You know, I was wondering if you were going to go on and plug your book on the show.
I certainly put my name up there, and since those guests are chosen by me, there that name was. But then the writers went on strike, and I've had to bump myself twice.
Huh. Now, you know, The Tonight Show has all these rituals that accompany it. I mean, the show opens exactly the same all the time, and it has for years and years. You know, Ed McMahon, if he's there, starts it, does the whole here's Johnny, does the whole hi-yo, and then, you know, bows to Carson. And then there's the banter between Carson and the band leader and Ed McMahon. Do you know how any of that started?
Well, I was a young child at the time. But I believe it was what all you want to acknowledge, the fact that Johnny is there, that Ed is that person, and Doc is that person, and the band is available. I think you do what people, and I don't want to sound being psychologically involved with The Tonight Show, but I do think that people have learned that The Tonight Show is what it has been the night before and the night before, not necessarily in subject matter, but that they, as they get into bed and turn out the light, ending that day, they see what they have seen and what they've enjoyed seeing for so long. I also believe that the people, the shows that have tried to scramble the format, the talk variety format, are among the quickest to leave.
So you think it's a good investment to just keep those rituals there all the time, have it be predictable?
I think if you kiss your wife good evening when you come home and goodbye when you leave in the morning, that's a ritual that should be continued, and that's in a sense what we're doing.
Another kissing ritual is when a woman guest is on the show, she has to kiss Johnny before sitting down on the couch.
She doesn't have to.
But she always does, right?
She also lifts the left leg and bends it to the back, and I don't know why they do that either.
Are there frequently newcomers who are just in shock about being on the show because they've watched the show for the last 20 years of their life?
You can tell, and their eyes betray them. There are lots of people who come on for the first show, and some who come on for the 50th time, who you can see their eyes dancing, and that they're just fine backstage. They're laughing and enjoying themselves. They come through that curtain, and you can see them freeze on the way over to that famous chair. But he does everything he can, and he's very good at it, Johnny, to try and ease into an interview so that it doesn't come on strong, like, hey, how is your new picture doing? He's liable to say, what a pretty dress, or if it's a man, what a pretty suit. He tries very hard to put people at ease, and I believe he's a master at it.
Johnny Carson is about as better known than the President of the United States is. You know what I mean? He's just so recognizable. He's so well-respected. Everybody knows him. Everybody watches the show or wants to be on the show. You're in the position of being the executive producer of his show. Is it hard to tell him your opinion when his opinion differs? I mean, since he's such...
Well, I've been there.
Johnny Carson. I know you have.
No, I was pointing out that I wouldn't be there if I kept pointing out that my opinion was different than his. We do have, and this is no self-analysis. I knew Johnny long before I did The Tonight Show. When I was doing the Benny shows, he was on several occasions one of our stars. We have, from the very beginning, had rather... similar reactions to people and things. And in the 18 years that I've been doing this job with him, I think our opinions have become even more closely attuned. So it isn't really liable to be a series of arguments about how did you book this person or why didn't you book this person. We pretty well know what we're thinking as we think together.
Now, you sometimes do the warm-ups, don't you, before the show starts?
I sure do.
What are some of the stories you use for that? Do you do shtick when you're warming up the audience?
What a thing to say. some jokes that I've learned over the years are non-topical and will last forever, and I indicate that this is one of those rare nights when Mr. Carson actually will be hosting the show. And I point out that... it's important for people in the audience to know each other. So if everybody in the audience, when I count three, will turn around and shake hands with the person directly behind them, it'll all make it a friendly group. When I count one, two, three, and they all turn around, of course, everybody is faced in the opposite direction. So that's the kind of intelligent, bright thing I do.
How do you usually go over?
Well, they're glad to be in out of the rain. And the price is right. It's pleasant, and the strange thing happens that even as a behind-the-scene person over the years, so many times Johnny has chatted with me on the air, that there is some kind of recognition that it is somebody truly connected with the show who is out there making a fool of himself.
Are there any shows that haunt you?
No, and I think I can explain why and not take too long in doing it. Our show is kind of like a baseball team in a baseball season. If you do one show a year or one show every 3 months or one show every 4 months, you have an awful lot of time to realize what a failure you've been. But we do kind of a baseball season. We do a show one night, and then we hope it's wonderful. And if not that, we hope it's good, and we hope it isn't bad. But even if it's a great show or even if it's not such a good show, we do another show the next night, and we have no time except in self-analysis to decide why it wasn't good or even why it was very good. We just do the next show and hope that that'll be a good one.
You had lots of TV experience before joining The Tonight Show. You were the producer of Burns and Allen show for a while on TV. That always struck me as a very, almost like an experimental video show. You know how, of course, you know, how George Burns always used to watch the action on his TV monitor? What a very inventive idea for a program.
Indeed. I knew George and Gracie from vaudeville when they did an act called Lamb Chops. And then I knew them, of course, on radio. Then when the time came, and parenthetically, the time has always come perfectly for me. Certainly somebody has been watching over me because I had... some sizable success here on Broadway, and just when that, I think, was about to end, somebody suggested that I direct motion pictures, and I did that at a couple of studios. Each time the success was bigger at the beginning than it was at the end, and just when I think the motion picture said, we can do without Fred, television came along, and Burns and Allen and December Bride and the Bob Cummings Show and all those wonderful years with Jack Benny and My Three Sons. And then again, here I was having an absolutely wonderful time when out of the clear blue sky somebody said, Carson is looking for a new producer and think you might be that person. And all has blended together into a remarkable long period of time. So, if that's long-winded, to get back to George and Gracie, George, who is his own head writer, has been most perceptive, most knowledgeable in what will make people laugh, and understandably so, after all of those years in vaudeville. So we took the vaudeville act of George and Gracie and moved it into radio and then into television.
You know what I've always wanted to know about Gracie? How did she feel about always having to play the part of the stupid person? Because all the jokes were based on her not getting the joke.
Oddly enough, when the vaudeville act started, George was a comedian and Gracie was the straight lady. And they didn't get any laughs that way, so they switched it around. And she felt just fine. She absolutely adored George. She enjoyed working. She knew that she was playing a part, and so I think did the public, because she was a very bright and knowledgeable young lady. So it was, you know, like Lucy didn't always trip and fall down, and Jack wasn't really miserly. I think the public recognized that they were playing characters. And she lived a very happy life with George, two children, and enormous success before she left. And isn't George remarkable after all these years to having the kind of career he has now?
Well, I want to talk with you more about other shows that you've produced on television, about your movies as well, including Bedtime for Bonzo. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Fred DeCordova, who has produced The Tonight Show, the executive producer, since 1970. And he's written a memoir which is titled Johnny Came Lately. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Fred DeCordova, executive producer of The Tonight Show and author of the new book, Johnny Came Lately. Now, you directed the film Bedtime for Bonzo, one of the very many films that you directed. Now, when you were working on it, I'm sure that, A, you never expected Ronald Reagan to become the president, and, B, that you never expected this movie to be revived as an example of the most absurd part of the President of the United States' career. Did you really like the film when you made it, or were you thinking of, oh, this is just an assignment and then it'll sink without a trace? What was your attitude toward the movie?
Well, in order of your questioning, I have never thought that anybody I was directing was going to be the President of the United States. yes, it was a regular program picture. Mr. Reagan, Ronnie, as I knew him then, was workmanlike, talented, inventive, and helpful actor. We thought the script was rather good, and so were the notices. I don't think a lot of us thought it would become one of the major discussionary items of political history, but I think both the president and I have seen it recently, or comparatively recently, and turned to each other and said, well, now what's all this fuss about? It was a pretty funny picture, and I think it was.
Was it ever hard for you to accept Ronald Reagan as President of the United States after you directed him as an actor?
No, not really. Ronnie had been the president of the Screen Actors Guild and was a studious and caring man, always. I think it was a surprise when he became governor, and he did such a good job as a governor of California. It didn't particularly surprise me that he would be presidential fodder. I know that in the White House, we were at a state dinner, Janet and I, Mr. Cordova, and after the toast of the dinner, we went walked through the White House before we went to hear Itzhak Perlman do some violin playing. And the president was talking to some people and called me over, and he said to those people, ladies and gentlemen, this is the man who is totally responsible for my being president of the United States. And a few eyebrows went up, and they turned around, and he said, yes, sir, ladies. If he hadn't directed me in Bedtime for Bonzo, I'd still be in motion pictures and somebody else would be here.
Do you ever feel guilty when Johnny Carson tells Reagan jokes in the opening monologue, since the president is a friend of yours and a former colleague?
I think the answer is yes. But I also think that I've been there. He's made presidential jokes about every president since he's been on the air. I think those jokes come from a recognition that almost any politician, president more so than most, of course, is fair game. They chose that career, and if they do something silly or something that seems silly, or make a mistake, if Ford fell down, or Jimmy Carter's a kind of way of talking, I think that the comedians immediately are attracted to the front page.
I'll tell you, just as a sidebar here, with Carson, I always get the feeling that the political jokes don't necessarily represent his politics at all, but rather the politics of the writers.
No, not in disagreement with you. I don't know, after all the years and all the time I've spent with Johnny, whether he's a Republican or a Democrat, I have no idea.
Oh, really?
I think he's totally apolitical. I think, the monologues are written by writers and very talented writers, and Johnny. Johnny will, at that 10 o'clock call that I mentioned, that he calls me every day, I'm liable to get a point of view of what he has read in the paper. And I find it absolutely astounding that he seems to say on the air on, let's say, Tuesday, what the public, after hearing him, seems that they have felt all along on Wednesday. He's a real leader of public opinion, I believe.
My guest is Fred DeCordova, who's the executive producer of The Tonight Show, has been that since 1970. He's also written an autobiography titled Johnny Came Lately. We have to spend some time talking about your parents. Your father was a con man, and a very theatrical one at that, and made his living doing some some pretty underhanded things.
Well, I think you phrased it nicely. That's exactly what he did. He was a dear man. He came up with a number of scams that since then have been tried by other people. I think he kept the ball in the air longer than most.
Well, tell one of the scams that kept you alive when you were a child.
Well, one of the famous pyramid scheme was really attributed to a man called Charles Ponzi, which is where you promise a high rate of interest and then keep paying that high rate to the people who put in the money first. And you don't really invest the money. You just keep taking money from the newcomers and add to the proceeds of the earlier investors. And Charles Ponzi once said in my presence that he, Ponzi, had gotten the credit and the jail time for doing what my father had really invented. And I think today it's kind of has still exists in the form of the pyramid schemes.
Well, you also moved from hotel to hotel as a child, right?
Only when necessary.
Father
and mother would live, and I must give mother credit, she was a very able assistant in these schemes. You lived in the highest style you could, and rather lavishly. And then when money kept coming in, you just continued to live at the sunspots of the world. And then if money stopped coming in, you began signing more checks rather than paying for them. Remember, this is long before credit cards. And there was a time lapse between the time you did something that you shouldn't have and then anybody discovered it. And then we would leave a forwarding address, say we were dissatisfied with the service in that hotel, we're moving elsewhere, and please send the bill to us and don't hold us up because our auditors will be upset. And then we would wait until some money came in from some other new scheme to pay off the thing and start all over again.
Were you ever asked to play a starring role in any of these schemes?
No, sir. My father was totally ashamed of what he did. And from a earliest age that I can remember, although I didn't know really why, he absolutely insisted on my being scrupulously honest. And nobody wants to go through life looking over his shoulder at what trouble may be catching up to him. I did have the fun of the last 20 years or so of their lives of calling them together when things got pretty good for me and say, now I know what's been going on. It's over as of now. From now on, you're my mother and my father. You're retired people, and there'll be no more of this. And I don't think I ever saw two more relieved people in my life.
When you were a kid, what did you tell your friends that your parents did for a living?
Oh, it depended what I thought he was doing. I did not know.
You weren't in on this at all?
Oh, no, 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 no. Oh. I thought he was an agent of the government. I thought he was an Internal Revenue man. I thought he was an explorer for the Baedeker guidebooks. It depended whatever part he was playing, and I just thought he was very talented, and I'm the talented man.
I must say, your childhood must have been the perfect rehearsal for a show business career.
I think so. I think I got to meet a lot of people under a lot of circumstances that normal young men wouldn't have.
And you learned to recognize a swindle when you saw one.
Not every time, but I'm a little more wary than most people.
You have been producing The Tonight Show since 1970.
Right.
Now, before you got there in 1970, in the 8 years preceding that, there were four different producers. Obviously, none of them lasted for very long, whereas you've been there for more than 17 years. Do you have any ideas of what made them go so quickly and what made you stay so long?
No, I don't. I do know that at various times I had... Those producers and I, three of the four of them, have crossed paths, and I thought all of them were very talented and very nice. And the man who was my immediate predecessor, a young gentleman called Rudy Tellez, I think had every reason to be terribly disappointed that he was terminated. But he waited around for the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks of my arrival on the scene and made everything as easy for me, told me everything that he thought would be of value to me. And instead of any mean-spirited attitude, he made my arrival on the scene a very happy and a very pleasant one. And I'm happy to say that he does very well now in another line of business.
If you don't mind me bringing this up, you're, I believe, 78 now, and Carson is in...
No, I'm not.
76?
77.
77, excuse me. Sorry.
I'm born in 1910, but on my way to being 78.
Okay. And Carson's in his 60s now.
Oh, gosh.
And everybody's always asking Carson if he's going to retire. What about you? Are you planning on retiring at all?
When he does.
Uh-huh. Do you have a pact or something?
No, I think we have this, that we're going to keep on doing this till I'm 100 and he's 82. He has a specific comment, and I think it's the total wrap-up of his attitude. He will keep on doing The Tonight Show as long as it is number one and as long as it is fun for him. And I believe that at no time in the history of The Tonight Show has the separation between The Tonight Show and any other talk radio version or talk variety version of a show ever has the separation been as wide. I think it is a more successful show now than it ever has been in the past. And as long as it stays like that, and he has fun doing it, and I believe he does, I know that he, more than most people, revolves his whole life around The Tonight Show. It is fun for him. It is hard work, but it is fun. I think we'll be around for a while.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Well, you're a delight. But everybody says that.
Thank you, Fred DeCordova. My guest has been Fred DeCordova, who since 1970 has been the executive producer of The Tonight Show. His new autobiography is titled Johnny Came Lately, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with the cultural correspondent for The New York Times, Herbert Mittgang. His new book, Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors, uncovers FBI files on writers such as Robert Frost, Dorothy Parker, Ernest Hemingway, and many others. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with choreographer and dancer Bebe Miller. One critic described her as a creator of tough, spunky, hard-edged dances, works that cloak tenderness with a veneer of steel. Miller is looked to as one of the most interesting of the current generation of emerging artists. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from experimental composer John Zorn. It's called Spillane, and it's Zorn's interpretation of the gritty and sleazy world of Mickey Spillane's detective novels. And television critic David Bianculli welcomes back the days and nights of Molly Dodd. The NBC series is back for its second season, and David says it's not too late to get hooked on the show or the show's star, Blair Brown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Representatives of the Nicaraguan government and the Contra rebels today began a new round of peace talks. This is the first time the negotiators have met without a mediator. Both sides have agreed to stop fighting during the three-day meeting. 9 crew members were injured today when an American military helicopter crashed in Honduras. The Pentagon says no one was killed. The helicopter was assigned to U.S. forces in Panama and was not part of the latest 3,200-troop airlift to Honduras. A spokesman for Honduran President José Ascona announced today that there are no Sandinista troops in Honduras anymore. U.S. officials in the country say the situation on the Honduran-Nicaraguan border has now stabilized following a reported invasion last week by Sandinista troops. David Adams reports.
Latest intelligence reports now indicate that the Sandinistas have completed their withdrawal from Honduras. The pullback apparently began on Friday and has allegedly been slowed down by Sandinista efforts to mine a 20-square-mile area of the border, which they occupied during the fighting. A Honduran presidential spokesman said that Honduras welcomed the announcement in Nicaragua of a halt to the Sandinista offensive against Contra guerrillas. A spokesman for the Honduran armed forces added that it could not be ruled out that some small bands of Sandinistas remain, but for all practical purposes their troops have left. He also said an undisclosed number of Honduran troops are being flown to the border region to begin a mine-clearing operation. The troops are being flown in Honduran helicopters. Meanwhile, away from the border region, 3,200 U.S. troops are conducting joint military exercises with Honduran troops, codenamed Golden Pheasant. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Honduras.
Strikes throughout Panama today closed down nearly all of the country's shops and factories. It's the largest show of opposition to date against the regime of General Manuel Noriega. Acting President Manuel Solis Palma has scheduled a broadcast address tonight to outline a new plan to relieve the country's cash shortage. The right-wing Arena Party is claiming a major victory in the National Assembly and municipal elections in El Salvador. Today, election officials confirmed that Arena has won over 50% of the vote, delivering a stunning blow to the ruling Christian Democratic Party. Tom Gibb reports.
It now seems very possible that Arena could win a majority over all the other parties in the National Assembly. The Christian Democrats have already conceded defeat in the race for mayor of San Salvador. The defeat of their candidate, Alejandro Duarte, will be a bitter personal blow to his father, President José Napoleón Duarte. It will also mean a big rethink before presidential elections in a year's time. Major Roberto Dabuisson is rumored to be the man in line for leader of the National Assembly if Arena gains control. And although official results are not yet out, Arena supporters are already celebrating. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
Today, the U.S. State Department said the elections in El Salvador are a victory for democracy. A federal judge today ordered Eastern Airlines to withdraw all applications to sell its shuttle service to another subsidiary of its parent company, Texas Air. And the judge ruled that if Eastern violates the order, it will face fines of $10,000 a day. The judge also ordered Eastern to inform all its employees that it has been found in contempt of court. The rulings are victories for Eastern's machinists' union, which had sued the company, but the union did not get the judge to order Eastern to reinstate any employees who may have quit because of the proposed sale. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 20 points to close at 2067.14. Declines led advances in trading of 128 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The work of saxophonist and composer John Zorn straddles written and improvised music, high and low culture, east and west. On recent albums, he's paid tribute to film composer Ennio Morricone, played compositions by bebop pianist Sonny Clarke, and set up a framework for improvisers based on the board game Cobra. Zorn's new album includes a tribute to crime novelist Mickey Spillane. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Sam was making my stomach pitch. I got back in the car before I opened my mouth. The gun bucked back like she did. She didn't have room for any pockets. There was a party of bullets going on inside her shirt.
John Zorn often sings the praises of the quick-change scores Carl Stalling wrote for classic Warner Brothers cartoons. Divorced from images of Porky, Daffy, and Bugs, Stalling's music is wonderfully disconnected and unpredictable. New themes emerge and disappear in a matter of seconds, as they do in much of Zorn's music. But Zorn knows that few of us listen to Stalling objectively. In those cartoons, as in Japan's kabuki theater, music is systematized and coded with meaning. If you listen to a cartoon blind, when you hear a descending slide guitar chord, you know a percussive crash will follow. You can practically see Wile E. Coyote dropping to the canyon floor. Spillane, the long title track from Zorn's new Nonesuch album, is his triumphant homage to 50s Pulp Fiction king and 80s beer salesman Mickey Spillane. It sounds like Carl Stalling's idea of a film noir soundtrack. Reedman Zorn and eight musicians, including guitarist Bill Frisell, drummer Bobby Previtt, and David Weinstein on sampling keyboards, thread together canned sound effects, atmospheric patches, variations on terse themes, and soundtrack cliches that create their own pictures.
Cigarettes and forgot to blow out the smoke.
In hack film scores, jazz is associated with sleazebags, gangsters, and losers. Zorn is one of the few composers since Ellington wrote his jungle music for the Cotton Club to make something positive of cheap stereotypes. His irony neutralizes the cliches without canceling their coarse vigor. Spillane has no narrative plot. Tawdry associations are the glue that hold it together. One way or another, they all refer to Mickey Spillane, that poet and pop icon of low living, or his brutal private eye hero, Mike Hammer. Zorn nails the exuberant tastelessness of hard-boiled writing. And in this context, Carol Emanuel's angelic harp suggests the delirious excess of Spillane sagas like Kiss Me Deadly. Zorn has pointedly cast musician/actor John Lurie as his Mike Hammer.
He gets to mumble ersatz Spillane-isms like, they ripped the stuffing out of my mattress, but they didn't touch the sheets on my bed. Lurie's surly hammer echoes the sour cynics he played in Jim Jarmusch's neo-noir films Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law. But Zorn's short scenes are paced like TV. Spillane is 25 minutes long, about the length of a 50s cop show. And the most obvious recurring motif is a quote from Nelson Riddle's Route 66 theme. A classic emblem of rootlessness becomes a unifying device. Also on the album are a composition for string quartet, Japanese soprano, and turntables, and Two Lane Highway, a blues concerto for guitarist Albert Collins. Collins may be the most harmonically imaginative of blues musicians, but Zorn's shifting backdrops don't coax him into stretching out as much as you might hope. It's not bad, but it's no Spillane either. Still, one triumph per album ought to be enough.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Spillane, John Zorn's new album on the Nonesuch label. This is Fresh Air. Choreographer and dancer Bebe Miller challenges dance stereotypes. She says being black, a woman, and a New Yorker all figure into her work. Her female dancers move with strength, aggression, and independence. Black and white couples dance together, both with tenderness and combativeness. Miller got her start dancing in the New York postmodern dance scene. In 1984, she formed her own company, and 2 years later, the New York dance community awarded Miller the prestigious Bessie Award for choreography. New York Times critic Jennifer Dunning wrote that Miller's performances give one the sense of witnessing quite complex emotions and relationships, as well as being invited to share in the delight of purely physical wit. I asked Bebe Miller to describe one of her dances, called Two.
It's about relationships. It seems to me to have everything that's tenuous and tender and incredibly aggressive and violent at the same time. I'm not really interested in generally in just sort of like discussing or describing life situations, but Two was a real opportunity to kind of just tackle what it is being female with a male and role playing a lot of the kind of miscommunication or non-communication that goes on between people who we assume care about each other or are linked in some fashion.
I like the tension in your dances. And,
uh-huh.
And the tension in Two and in parts of Habit of Attraction of untangling yourself from a lover's hold on you.
You mean physically untangling,
yeah.
Like taking his hands off
exactly,
your face?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And kind of climbing out of an embrace.
Uh-huh. It's funny, there are not many embraces that sort of stay and you feel like a real, you know, tenderness. I mean, it might start off that way, but all of a sudden you realize that you're locked in someone's arms and you really don't want to stay there. And I don't know. I think working with the dancers, they had a lot of problems sometimes just in dealing with this material because there is a lot of unconscious, you know, well, if I'm in this kind of relationship, I'm just going to leave. But in working on a piece, you can't leave and can't walk off the stage. You have to deal with it. So you have to deal with somebody being really repressive and oppressive to your person. And how do you, you know, handle that?
I think of you as, in a way, bringing innovations from abstract dance and putting it into a more narrative context.
Uh-huh.
Do you think of yourself as doing that?
Yeah, that's a pretty good way of putting at it. I think my primary, the way I see myself most is as a mover. As, I mean, physical daring, risk, movement is what interests me the most. But I found it really hard to separate the rest of my life from my work. You know, I'd go into the studio and then just like, okay, let's deal with some movement. Let's just deal with some steps. And then I'd go home and have a fight. And not that I want to, like, you know, kind of, you know, use art as therapy here, but I think there is enough compartmentalizing in life as it is that I wanted to kind of join my whole forces so that I can approach a problem with hearing what I heard on the news, what I feel at home, what I look at on the street, all of that somehow finds its way into dancing. And I find it's a lot more interesting for me that way.
A lot of choreographers don't start choreographing until they've retired from dance. And you're still pretty young. You're certainly still dancing. You dance your own works.
Uh-huh.
What made you want to start choreographing?
Oh, boy. I never really saw myself as someone who would not choreograph. It didn't just dawn on me. I think when maybe it was my earlier work when I was a kid, I did a lot of composition, improvisation. The idea of dancing and making dances seemed to be the same thing for me. And also, I never was one of those really versatile dancers who could do anything and do triple turns and splits and all this kind of stuff. So I figured that I would have to do my own work anyway if I wanted to get out there.
You have both black and white dancers in your company.
Yeah.
And in the duet dances, you don't couple them off according to race. And I think it's interesting that you do that.
But in a way, they are coupled off by race.
You mean?
I mean, it's not...
Intentionally integrated?
Well, I mean, I'm very aware that a certain kind of statement is made when it's a black and white couple that's mm-hmm. very different than it's when it's two blacks or two whites mm-hmm. or two women or two men. And it's not that I'm making a point of that, but I mean, you know, I'm living in the 80s here, and, you know, everything is a statement in some way. The dance we're talking about, Habit of Attraction, one of the couples is a black man and a white woman with blonde hair, no less. And it's the most repressive pairing, I think, in the piece. There's a lot of mutual holding back. There's a lot of angry, kind of nasty force. And we took this piece to Atlanta in South Carolina, and I was really concerned as to, like, I wonder who's going to see this and if there's going to be any kind of a mention made about this on a racial basis.
Did you ever feel that there were limitations on you as a black dancer when you were getting started? Limitations in the companies that you could join is what I mean.
Probably, yeah. There are a lot of companies I wasn't even considering joining. And, you know, really overtly or unconsciously, there might have been a racial reason why. But I think that it kind of worked both ways. One, I wasn't interested in joining a traditional dance, you know, normal whitish company, because that kind of work wasn't really interesting to me. I was also not interested in joining an all-black company for another set of reasons.
What were those reasons?
Well, the black companies that I had were seeing at the time in the 70s were not doing work that I was interested in, like ALE Company. I mean, I think it's really important, but it wasn't my own particular voice. It wasn't my style of moving. At the time that I started dancing, I was kind of concerned more with, you know, in a real selfish way, perhaps, like, how do I feel as a dancer? What kind of steps interest me? What kind of movement is what, you know, turns me on? That was really my interest. I wasn't really, didn't want to make a political manifesto or statement in dancing.
You know, I read about you that at age 5, I think, you started studying in an Alwyn Nikolai Murray Lewis company for children. And I was thinking, gosh, how lucky you were. Most five-year-olds who get dance lessons are put into some, like, dance company for kids. Yeah, with either tutus or, like, really bad interpretive dance.
Yeah.
Or dancing to, like, the worst pop music on the radio.
Yeah, I was really lucky. I didn't even know it. I mean, you know, at five years old, you just kind of show up because your mother brings you and you just
Your mother must
there.
Have been pretty hip to bring you to that place.
Yeah, she was pretty cool. She was looking for an adult dance class because she had arthritis, and rather than pay a babysitter, she kind of took us all along. So we showed up every Saturday, and I did improv. We improvised about clouds. We, you know, danced like a green chiffon scarf. I mean, it is. And it just seemed totally natural. I thought everybody did that. I knew that a lot of my friends didn't, but I just thought that that's what dancing was about. It wasn't until I got to graduate school that I found out about people like Merce Cunningham and Paul Taylor or the Judson Movement, and I just kind of had my eyes opened a little wider, let's say.
Some dancers, once they start establishing themselves as choreographers, cut back on their dancing. Are you looking forward to dancing less, or do you want to keep dancing as much as you can, as long as you can?
You know, that depends on the day or the season. There was a time like 6 months ago I said, you know, I think I'm going to start easing my way out. You know, let the sun set and the dancers take off, and I'll just be in the background. And then I changed my mind because I really like it. I don't know. It's a drug in a way. It gets harder to keep it up. It's harder to stay in shape. But I don't want to dance past the point of when I feel like I should stop. But I feel invigorated now. I feel like there's no real reason to take myself out of everything. I am dancing less than I used to, which is fine. And I'm enjoying the role of being a choreographer who sits out and watches. I mean, you can see a lot more about how a piece is made when you're not in it. And that I appreciate very much. I mean, that's a real a growth point, I think.
B.B. Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. This was a great interview.
Choreographer and dancer B.B. Miller spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in New York. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Oh, we're following some high-level diplomacy. In Washington, Secretary of State Schultz is hosting Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze for talks. Also, inside Nicaragua, the Nicaraguan government is meeting with the Contras in ceasefire talks. We're also looking ahead to this weekend's caucuses in the state of Michigan and how the Democrats might do there. And we're hearing the advice that editor Michael Lerner of Tikkun Magazine offers the Democratic Party as to how they might capture the White House in November. He says the Democrats have to demonstrate more compassion for middle class and working people.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our television critic David Bianculli says there are some especially worthwhile programs airing this week, an ABC TV movie about homelessness called God Bless the Child, and an NBC miniseries based on Gore Vidal's novel about Abraham Lincoln. But David is most excited about a series that's beginning its second season this Thursday night.
What's your name?
Me? Dodd. Molly. Dodd. D-O-D-D. Do you need to write that down?
No. I'll remember it. Molly Dodd.
Who could forget? The days and nights of Molly Dodd burst onto NBC last spring like a breath of fresh TV. Molly Dodd, played by Blair Brown, wasn't a TV character at all. She was astoundingly real and different and kind of crazy. What a show. Jay Tarsus, who created the series and wrote or directed most of last year's episodes, really pushed the envelope with Molly Dodd. He filmed it like a movie, on actual city streets as well as on a soundstage, and didn't use a laugh track. A few other shows have tried that, too, but Molly Dodd did two other things that made it very, very special. Instead of inventing a cast of characters that had to show up in every episode, as in almost every other sitcom ever made, Tarsus lets the days and nights of Molly Dodd look more like real life. In other words, The ex-husband who visits her for 3 episodes in a row might not show up again for weeks. Characters come and go, never to be seen again. And Molly, who has problems holding a job, interacts with different sets of people all the time. That structure is one of the special things about The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. The other is the humor, which takes a similarly long-range approach. In Molly, the humor doesn't come from one-liners and put-downs. It comes from knowing the history of the Molly Dodd character, which, to this point, includes a charming but irresponsible ex-husband, a thoroughly slimy ex-boss and ex-lover, a series of doomed relationships, a nervous breakdown, and a series of revealing therapy sessions. As Molly Dodd returns for its 2nd season this Thursday night, Molly meets a dazzlingly handsome detective, goes to a job interview in an antiquarian bookstore, and gets a new job. End of show. Next week, she goes out with a detective and runs into her slimy ex-boss, who appeared in the very first episode of Molly Dodd. The woman has a history, and knowing it makes this show a lot funnier. But even if you're coming to Molly Dodd fresh this season, you'll catch up and catch on very quickly. Blair Brown is so wonderful as Molly, it's impossible to imagine any other actress doing the role. Jay Tarsis is writing the kind of TV that Patty Chayefsky used to write, and Blair Brown is attacking her scenes, and especially her monologues, with an astounding amount of energy and skill. Here she is, confronting her psychiatrist about why Molly feels rejected by her.
Maybe it was something bad that I said, or I didn't say. Ah, now see, I'm relatively new at all of this, and, you know, if there's like some mimeographed sheet of rules that I could study, or like some book that I could take home, and, you know, I could maybe learn to become the kind of patient that we all hoped that I would be, and that we thought that I was on the road to becoming until I blew it by doing whatever it was that I did, or that I didn't do.
That's only a piece of it, but you get the idea. Since Molly Dodd was taken off the schedule last fall, such shows as Frank's Place and another Jay Tarsis comedy, The Slap Maxwell Story, have taken Molly's lead and successfully tried new things, new approaches, unusual characters. But The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd is the original, and it's back, and it's better than ever. And that's pretty impressive, because it was great to begin with.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, Saturday Night Live veteran Al Franken does his versions of presidential hopefuls Pat Robertson and Paul Simon and describes the research he's done to lampoon the primaries. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the band Brinsley Schwartz. During the 70s, this band started the pub rock scene, where people put off by the glamour and posturing of rock stars could hear rock and roll in informal and inexpensive surroundings. And book critic John Leonard reviews 2 new biographies of the late Roy Cohn, Senator Joseph McCarthy's aide and confidant. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller, who produced today's show with Amy Sallet, Ed Doherty, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Warren Kozak. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.